On this week's 51%, we'll hear about gifts, gifts that know no special time of year. We'll meet one young woman who is behind an effort to donate food, and we'll travel abroad to meet another young woman intent upon educating her country's youth, especially girls.
Of course, to provide education for the children, especially for the girls, it's not easy in Afghanistan.
Then we'll hear about women whose gift is and was their poetry. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Aisha Fareed returned to her home country compelled to share what she had received in education. As reporter Misha Wilmers tells us, Aisha grew up in refugee camps after her family fled Afghanistan from Russian attacks in 1983.
From the colorful girls' unit of her orphanage, Aisha Fareed talks boldly about the extraordinary personal journey which shaped her view of the world. On the day she was born in 1983, Aisha's home was turned to rubble by a Soviet airstrike. Her family fled to Iran, where she spent much of her childhood experiencing the hardship of life as a refugee.
When I grew up in that refugee camp, I saw many children. They lost their lives due to very preventable diseases like diarrhea, fever, and there was not even drinking water. People used to walk miles to fetch water. Living in such a circumstance, with no facilities, with no access to the very basic human rights, like school or medical facilities, it was very difficult. But in the meantime, it made a huge difference in my life as well.
Fortunately, Aisha was able to receive an education, and at 6 years old, her parents sent her to school in Pakistan.
I was one of the luckiest children, or the fortunate children among all those thousands of children living in a terrible situation. The moment I realized how fortunate I was, I thought I should give it to my nation, to my country, what my country desperately needs.
And Aisha was true to her word. She founded AFSECO, the Afghan Child Education and Care Organization. Her mission was to provide a portion of the country's estimated 1.6 million orphans with an opportunity to receive a quality education.
All these children who are living in this orphanage, all of them are going to the public schools run by the Afghan government. But we provide them extra tuition. We provide them science classes like mathematics, biology, physics, chemistry, history and geography.
Aisha's work with the orphanage has won her fans all over the world.
Aisha Fareed, an extraordinary woman from Afghanistan who's taken great risks to educate the next generation, one girl at a time. And together they point the way to a future where progress is shared and prosperity is sustainable.
Praise indeed from U.S. President Barack Obama, who mentioned her in a speech on social entrepreneurship in 2010.
No doubt being recognized by different organizations from different parts of the world really impacted or made a difference in my work as well. Of course, I feel proud of the achievement me and my entire team we received. It's also a recognition for these children who suffered the most or who are the ones who deserve to be recognized.
Following a brief tour of the building, we also meet part-time tutor Maboba, who explains why AFSECO is different from other orphanages and schools in Afghanistan.
I don't see any other organization like AFSECO that gives, you know, this kind of chances to their children. Like, you know, we have art classes, music classes, different programs we have. And they can be, you know, whatever they want. Everything is ready for them. You know, they don't lack anything. I've been here since many years, so I love helping my mates or my friends. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of pleasure. Mm-hmm. And also, I feel proud.
Over the years, Aisha says her organization has faced many challenges.
Of course, to provide education for the children, especially for the girls, it's not easy in Afghanistan. Within the Afghan government, there are some elements that do not support women's rights or simply they do not support women's education. And this is really a huge challenge on our way. because we have been having some difficulties in the last 2 years to simply educate these guys, to simply provide the same equal opportunities for both boys and girls.
But nothing will get in the way of Andaisha's determination to enrich the lives of the orphans and build a better future for her country.
My vision is to see all these beautiful children to build Afghanistan's future. I would like to see engineers for to build Afghanistan's future, doctors to take care of the Afghans, and teachers, which Afghan people desperately need, midwives, because Afghanistan still has the highest mortality in the world, or physicians, simply to provide education for these children, simply to provide a safe and peaceful environment or friendly environment for these children makes a huge difference in these children's life, and these children make a huge difference in Afghanistan's life, future as well.
Misha Wilmers, DW.
Every day, millions upon millions of pounds of food are thrown away in the United States. A 20-year-old University of California, Berkeley student is doing her part to change this and donates her time to managing the website that in turn manages private food donations. And Sophie Brandlin reports from Berkeley.
It's dinner time at UC Berkeley, and here in the dining hall, students are piling their plates high with food. Chicken, pizza, pasta, fries, the choices seem limitless. But quite a lot of this food will end up in the trash. That bothered Chloe Zhang so much that she wanted to do something about it.
It's about walking down the streets of Berkeley and seeing that people don't have homes, don't have food and security or even basic shelter, and noticing the disparity at the dining halls where so much food was going to waste, and it just didn't seem right.
Chloe is a junior at UC Berkeley, studying molecular environmental biology and global poverty in practice. In her spare time, the 20-year-old is the president of Feeding Forward, a non-profit organization that fights food waste and hunger in the local San Francisco Bay Area.
We don't see it as a problem of lack of resources, but rather an inequitable distribution of it.
We're sitting on a sunny winter day in Berkeley's Sproul Plaza, where the infamous free speech movement was born back in the 1960s. Thousands of students protested here, demanding the right to politically organize on campus. Chloe's work follows in this tradition of activism. Her aim is to help Berkeley's large homeless population.
I think there's a sense that food is a fundamental human right, and I really believe that. And coming to Berkeley really opened my eyes to seeing how people aren't able to support themselves with these basic needs, and I just felt the urge to do something. So what we do is that we connect those with excess food to those in need.
By means of technology, Chloe's organization, Feeding Forward, runs a website and a smartphone app. It was started by a fellow student at UC Berkeley. So how does Feeding Forward work? Let's say a restaurant, organization, or family has at least 10 pounds of leftover food. Feeding Forward allows them to quickly and easily donate it. They let Feeding Forward know about the available food by describing it on the website or the app. Feeding Forward takes care of the rest.
All you do is post your donation and it will ask you how many pounds of food you have, what kind of vehicle the food can fit into, and what times are you available for having a volunteer to come by and pick it up.
An algorithm then matches the donation with nearby organizations like homeless shelters that can use the food right away. Once the food is delivered, a Feeding Forward volunteer snaps a photo of it and sends it back to the original donor to show that it didn't go to waste. It's like instant karma. 21-year-old Dominique Martinez is one of the Feeding Forward's 150 volunteers. The UC Berkeley student got involved because she believes in the mission and says the food runs give her the chance to personally see the happy faces of donors and recipients.
They made it so simple that it's crazy like not to get into it. When we go pick up the food, like the people are really nice and generous. And then when we donate the food, like, you could see genuine smiles on their faces. They're really grateful for what we're doing.
According to Feeding Forward, 263 million pounds of consumable food is thrown away every day in the United States. That's enough food to fill a football stadium to the brim. At the same time, nearly one out of every six adults doesn't know where their next meal will come from. Some restaurants on campus are working with Feeding Forward to try to change that. Samuel Hernandez is the supervisor at the Golden Bear Cafe right by Sproul Plaza. He used to throw out the leftover food every weekend. But since Chloe approached him a year ago and suggested he donate the food, he now uses the Feeding Forward website to give away the leftovers every Friday before the cafe closes for the weekend.
It's probably about 30 sandwiches, 25 burritos, and maybe 20 pounds of fresh fruit, pastries too.
Hernandez is from El Salvador and says it still pains him when food goes to waste.
I feel so bad in the past seeing all this food going in the garbage. I feel way better, that somebody's eating it, especially in my background back home, that a lot of people hungry.
Chloe and I walk across the street to visit one of Feeding Forward's recipients, the Berkeley Food and Housing Project.
I guess they're open right now, but I'm not sure if there's anyone we can talk to.
There is. Terry Light is the executive director and makes sure that a hot meal is provided to the 100 to 150 homeless people that come into the shelter every day. She says demand is increasing.
Food banks all across the Bay Area have been reporting more people coming in asking for food, and food banks in general, it seems, have been inundated in the last few years.
The meals come from various food banks and private donors. The only problem is that most nonprofits don't have the capacity to pick up donations.
Because we're so leanly staffed that unless donations can come to us, we usually can't take them. So there's a lot of things we've had to pass up in the past because people said, well, we have this, can you come get it? And we're like, our one kitchen person's cooking the meal, so they can't leave.
This is where Feeding Forward's delivery volunteers can come in handy.
Having people bring it to us, I know, is a big thing. So that transportation, that is a game changer for us.
And it's a game changer for the person who delivers the food as well.
You bring that food here, you serve it yourself, and then you will see like how grateful people are.
And that's why Zhang got involved in the first place and why she wants to keep doing this.
We need more people to be involved because this is a movement and really needs to start with individuals stepping up. I'm really passionate about this and hope to continue in my future career as well.
For DW, this is Anna-Sophie Brendlin in Berkeley.
Every 10 years, the Furious Flower Poetry Conference is held at James Madison University in Virginia. This year, the event was dedicated to renowned poet Rita Dove. Lilia Fukin has the story.
I shall not be moved. I'm like a tree that's planted by the water.
As hundreds of poets gathered, an ensemble sang Maya Angelou's poem, Our Grandmothers. This Furious Flower Conference celebrates the burgeoning voice of African-American poets. Past honorees have been Gwendolyn Brooks, Ameri Baraka, and Sonia Sanchez. This year's guest of honor, Rita Dove, reads from her poem, Reunion.
Who are all these children? Who had them and with whom? Through the general coffee tones, the shamed genetics cut a creamy swath. Cherokee's burnt umber transposed onto generous lips, a glance flaring gray above the crushed nose we label anonymous African. It's all here. The beautiful geometry of Mendel's peas and their grim logic.
Dove teaches English at the University of Virginia. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner and has received 25 honorary doctorate degrees. When she became the youngest United States poet laureate, she was flooded with mail.
People will write me and say, you know, you should do this or you should get on Sesame Street. And what they're saying is that poetry is not in our lives.
Dove says that in school, even she was terrified of interpreting poetry.
The idea of getting it wrong overrides any kind of openness to what it can be.
So, as United States Poet Laureate, she made it her mission to take the fear out of the equation and bring poetry into our daily lives.
Which meant poems on buses, which meant Sesame Street, which meant going to the Naval Academy, which meant bringing children from the Crow Indian Reservation to the Library of Congress, which meant, you know, bringing jazz musicians and poets together. Every little thing.
It's been working. The voices of African American poets are flourishing today. Conference attendees were showered with readings by the likes of Nikki Giovanni, Frank X. Walker, Mariah Dessa Ikeri Tali, Elizabeth Alexander, Cornelius Eady, Toy Derricotte, Yusef Kumanyaka, and Ishmael Reed. Rita Dove says credit is due to Joanne Gabin, the visionary founder of the Furious Flower Conference.
The idea behind this, I think, for Joanne was that there are no camps. The common denominator is that we're African-American or we care about African-American experience, but the celebration is poetry.
Printed on the inside of the Furious Flower program are a few lines from Rita Dove. The last line says, "If you can't be free, be a mystery." I'm Lilia Fukin.
Gilles Malkin has an edition of Women in History. This week, his subject is the first woman who was recognized as an accomplished New World poet.
Anne Dudley Bradstreet arrived at Salem with the Puritans and the Massachusetts Bay Colony from Northampton, England, in 1630 on the flagship Arabella. The trip must have been quite an adventure for her, since she'd been raised in luxury on the estates of the Puritan Earl of Lincoln, where her father was the chief steward. As a child, she survived a bout of smallpox and another of rheumatic fever, and despite the repression to which she was subjected in her life, she steered her own ship with a confidence born of personal faith, and so is known today as America's first poet. She was married to Simon Bradstreet, an assistant to the governor and later twice governor himself, whose diplomatic work obliged him to travel a good deal. Anne remained at home and took solace in her father's great library of books. It was from this source that she was able to find comfort from loneliness, expand her intellect, and educate her children. She wrote in secret, as the Massachusetts Bay Colony's mores did not include the encouragement of women to think, express their opinions, or write, three of her most basic needs. One of Anne's closest friends, Anne Hutchinson, did so without a care for the consequences of using her vastly superior mind to those of the men of the colony, especially on religious subjects. Her reward for baffling them was simply to be expelled from the community. But that's another story. Anne Dudley Bradstreet never intended or even consented to make her writing known. It was secretly carted away to England by a brother-in-law, Reverend John Woodbridge, and published there as The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up in America by a Gentlewoman of Those Parts, in 1650. It's in question whether his purpose was to glorify the advent of a woman thinker or to enshrine the mother and wife aspect that she accepted and exemplified so superbly, and which helped make possible her acceptance as a writer. From this position, she posited her happiness in marriage to other women. Either way, it sold well on both sides of the Atlantic, and her words caught the imagination of women of her time and after. Anne was a thinker and set great value to the development of her mind. She knew the world outside her door had no place for her secret self. She wrote, "I'm obnoxious to each carping tongue who says my hand a needle better fits. A poet's pen all scorn I should thus wrong. For such despite they cast on female wits. If what I do prove well, it won't advance. They'll say it's stolen, or else it was by chance." It was therefore because Anne walked the fence that she was given the chance in print. She wrote about men's superiority in order to gain a favorable comparison with women, but also wrote that the ancient Greeks had recognized their nine muses as being women. How strange that was. In 1678, a posthumous collection of her work titled Several Poems Compiled with Great Variety of Wit and Learning included poetry about her devotion to her husband. "I prize thy love more than whole mines of gold, or all the riches that the east doth hold. My love is such that rivers cannot quench, nor aught but love from thee give recompense." Her feminist beliefs notwithstanding, Anne decided to accept the traditional role of women in her society. She was devoted to it, to her husband, to the church, and to the prospect of promoting the well-being of her eight children. Her religious faith provided her with refuge when the family's house burned down in 1666, taking most of her father's library from her. Unshaken, she wrote, "And when I could no longer look, I blessed his grace that gave and took. that laid my goods now in the dust. Yea, so it was, and so 'twas just. It was his own, it was not mine. Far be it that I should repine. Anne Dudley Bradstreet wrote about life as it was, with no resentment or sentimentality. She accepted the world, yet she found the way to voice her criticism of it without attempting to usurp it. She died from tuberculosis on September 16, 1672, in Andover, Massachusetts. Her voice is clearly heard among those of her era with the most to say, laying essential groundwork for the later efforts of women to achieve emancipation from their ill-deserved domestic chains. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin is a resident of the Catskills region of New York. Are you the kind of person whose favorite holiday party is a party of one? Well, do we have some good news for you. Humorist Sharon Glassman shares 12 months of 2015 holidays that are perfect for quiet folks and for those of us who'd like even more to celebrate. Glassman, who describes herself as a performing introvert, asks, was Frank Sinatra a quiet guy at heart? Well, the answer may surprise you, as many plan to celebrate Old Blue Eyes' 100th birthday in 2015.
Ah, the holiday season. America's peak time for boisterous gatherings, parades, and energetic festivities. The annual highlight for people who love people, crave a packed party schedule, and revel in the roar of New Year's Eve crowds. But what if you're a quieter type of person? An introspective type whose ideal holiday bash is a silent party of one. The good news is, there are holidays that just say yes to those of us who are naturally inclined to just say no to the boom boom and party party of the normal holiday season. It all starts on January 1st with Silent Record Week. Get out your air guitar, turn on your lip syncing skills, and play along to the delightful sounds of nothing at all. February 14th, American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting. Hey there, Einstein, what's not to love? March 20th, spring. Shades of gray leading to lovely deferred rewards. May 3rd is World Laughter Day. Read a nerdy book, watch a dorky movie, or giggle at nothing at all. The act of laughing boosts endorphins. What tickles your funny bone, that's up to you. May 29th, Rhode Island Ratification Day. A tasteful nod to small states' positive constitutional powers. Third week of September, Indoor Plant Week. Fresh air, natural beauty, and best of all, no one saying, hey kid, why don't you like to play outside? October 4th, Kentucky Apple Festival. This one's actually a huge party, but there's apples and clogging. November 24th, celebrate your unique talent day. Everyone wins and no one has to get on stage. December 12th, Frank Sinatra's birthday. Hey, hold on a second there, quiet holiday lady, you may be thinking. Frank Sinatra was not a quiet holiday kind of guy. Trust me, I don't want to rattle the apple cart. I'm not the type to pick a fight. But before you skip over Francis Albert Sinatra's birthday as being too loud or brash or in your face of a holiday for quiet folks like us, do me a favor, would you? Listen to Frank Sinatra sing an early version of the Harold Arlen Johnny Mercer tune, One for My Baby. And tell me, please, is it just me waxing hopeful? Or was the chairman of the board a quiet type at heart, too? I'll accept what you say. I don't want to push. But that early Sinatra sound, it's something to celebrate, I think. How about you?
Sharon Glassman is the author of what she calls a live novel with songs, Blame It on Hoboken, which sets an inspiring love story in Sinatra's New Jersey hometown. Glassman, however, lives in northern Colorado. And that's our show for this week, wherever you live. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1327.